A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll hear about Carnegie Hall's 2019-2020 season, which includes a series of programs to celebrate the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. My guests will be Carnegie Hall Executive and Artistic Director Clive Gillinson, who will walk us through the next year's season and also talk about the upcoming Migrations Festival next month, exploring the impact of immigration on American music throughout the ages. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Composer Dominic Argento, whose musical works included the Pulitzer Prize-winning song cycle From the Diary of Virginia Woolf, has passed away. A widely performed composer of mostly opera and choral works, he also won a Grammy Award for a recording by Frederica von Stade and the Minnesota Orchestra of his song cycle, Casa Guidi. According to the Minnesota Star Tribune, Argento taught composition at the University of Minnesota from 1958 to 1997 and wrote many of his works for the Minnesota Orchestra and Minnesota Opera, which he helped found. Born in York, Pennsylvania, Argento studied at the Peabody Institute and the Eastman School of Music. Argento was 91. New productions of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, Philip Glass's Akhenaten, and Handel's Agrippina, and new Sunday matinees are among the features of the Metropolitan Opera's 2019-2020 season. The season lineup, announced this week, also includes new stagings of Berg's Vosek and Wagner's Flying Dutchman. According to the Met, Porgy and Bess, conducted by David Robertson, will open the Met season in September. Yannick Nézet-Séguin, who's now in his first season as music director, will conduct Vosek and revivals of Turandot and Werther, in addition to the New Year's Eve gala and two Met orchestra concerts at Carnegie Hall. The Met also said that recent union negotiations opened the way to offer 16 Sunday matinees, a number the Met said it hopes to increase the following season. Full details on the season can be found at metopera.org. The Boston Symphony Orchestra has settled a lawsuit brought by its principal flutist, who alleged pay discrimination because her pay was substantially less than that of the orchestra's principal oboist. According to the Boston Business Journal, the suit by flutist Elizabeth Rowe was the first brought under Massachusetts's new Equal Pay Act, which requires that men and women be paid equally for comparable work. The orchestra had argued that her role and that of the principal oboist were not comparable. Details of the settlement were not disclosed. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. As we head into the 2019-2020 season, we can expect to hear a lot about the celebrations of the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. Among the organizations weaving this into their programming is Carnegie Hall, which is planning two full symphony cycles, as well as performances of all of the piano sonatas by pianists including Yefim Bronfman, Yevgeny Kissin, and Maurizio Pollini, and the string quartets. The celebratory year will also include altogether A Global Ode to Joy, which will feature performances of the Ninth Symphony by eight orchestras on five different continents conducted by Maren Alsop, but not all at the same time. The Ode to Joy initiative will also bring together partners and young people to explore and reinterpret Ode to Joy in a contemporary context. The season itself is dedicated to Isaac Stern, whose centenary will be marked in 2020, and who played a key role in Carnegie Hall's survival when it was threatened with demolition in 1960. Carnegie Hall will welcome composer and clarinetist Jörg Widmann to hold its Debs Composer's Chair, and its prospective artists will be conductors Yannick Nézet-Séguin and John Elliott Gardner, mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato, and Benin-born singer-songwriter Angelique Kidjo. There will also be a wide variety of programs offered through the Weill Music Institute. I had the chance to speak with Carnegie Hall's executive and artistic director, Clive Gillinson, about next year's season. Our conversation also touched on its upcoming Migrations Festival, scheduled for this March, which will celebrate the influence of immigration to and migration through America on its music and culture, particularly by African Americans, the Scots-Irish, and Eastern European Jewish immigrants. In speaking of next year's season, I started off by asking Gillinson how Carnegie Hall felt it could best approach a celebration of one of classical music's composer icons.
Well, on this occasion, we just felt we had to do something very, very comprehensive, but with a particular focus on the areas where we feel he'd been such a pivotal figure in music, and where, I mean, essentially those art forms or areas of the art form were changed forever by his contribution, I mean, which is really the symphonies, the string quartets, the piano sonatas. I mean, we also are representing a lot else of his music as well, but we firstly are not only doing one cycle of the symphonies, but I mean, we're doing two cycles, which is something we would never, ever do at any other time, or probably with any other composer either. And we really wanted audiences to have a chance to compare how these interpretations sound with contemporary instruments, but also as they might have sounded in his day with Sir John Eliot Gardner. So it's a unique presentation to do that in that year. We're also doing the complete string quartets as well as the complete piano sonatas. And I mean, the reason for focusing on Beethoven in this way is we genuinely feel he's probably the composer who had the biggest impact on music and the development of music in history. I mean, obviously, there were many other geniuses, you know, whether you look at Bach or Mozart and so on, but the art form wasn't completely different after they'd lived than before because of them.
And now three of your prospective artists will be involved in that. What do they each bring to the way you're presenting it?
Well, Sir John Eliot Gardner clearly, you know, is one of the great, I mean, not just students, but I mean, he's a great conductor, but he is, you know, really one of the great experts on the playing of the time and how one interprets the music as Beethoven would have heard it and how he would have written it and expected to hear it. So that is why he is a perspectives artist and why he plays such a central role here. Yannick Nezis again, is participating, I mean, with a contemporary view on the music, but also, I mean, his perspectives is very broadly based as well. He's working with two other orchestras that have been central to his life, you know, his orchestra from Canada as well as the Met Opera Orchestra. So, you know, he has a very, very major role, which is much broader based, but with Beethoven at the center of it. And Joyce DiDonato, of course, is a perspectives artist and exploring in a very broad way. I mean, she's participating in this project, but she's also doing not only a lot of performance, but a lot on the education side as well. And one of the reasons we wanted to bring Joyce back again, it'll be 5 years since she was a perspectives artist here, was we really wanted to explore her commitment to education, where she's such a passionate advocate and believer.
Well, the education part of the Beethoven celebration will certainly bring in the Weill Music Institute, and you're planning a festival or a celebration called All Together. What was the genesis behind that idea, and what do you envision with that?
Well, we do what we call creative learning projects every 2 or 3 years. So, you know, we've done very, very big projects like that, you know, and involving kids, you know, as well as participants, but as performers. So they, you know, they're very exciting projects for students to be involved with. And we felt in the Beethoven year, there was only one piece one could put at the core of that, which was the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, which obviously has been such a pivotal work in so many ways. And when you think as well, even today, I mean, you know, if there's a huge historic event that happens, I mean, it's not today, but something even like the fall of the Berlin Wall, Beethoven Ninth Symphony is the piece that people play and choose to play at those great historic turning points. So we felt it needed to be the centerpiece of our education work that year as well. And Marin Alsop came up with this idea of turning it into a global commitment. And you know, just really involving orchestras in very, very different countries, really right across the globe. So, I mean, you probably know, I mean, it's the Sao Paulo Symphony Orchestra, the South Bank Centre in London, the Baltimore Symphony, which is her orchestra here in the US, New Zealand Symphony Orchestra, Sydney Symphony Orchestra, the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra, Johannesburg Philharmonic, and KwaZulu-Natal Philharmonic Orchestra. So it really does span the world, and you know, and across very, very different cultures. And interesting, yet again, that you see how Beethoven 9 still, for all those different cultures and those different countries, is still such a central focus.
Mm. Well, and looking at the education side of that as well, there's so much discussion nowadays about the relevance of classical music, particularly composers of days gone by. What do you feel Beethoven can teach young people today about music and about the world?
Well, firstly, he was one of the first composers who actually really was politically engaged. I mean, there were a lot of things around social values that he absolutely believed in. And obviously, the Ode to Joy, you know, is such a big statement as well. And so one of the things we're asking all the kids to do, and I think this is why it's engaged so many orchestras and so many organizations, is to write their own view of the relevance of this music and what he's talking about with this music, to write their own pieces and write their own words, but to, you know, to develop projects that really are inspired by this, but, you know, that, that relate to the world we live in today. So every one of those ensembles, you know, the eight others, nine including us, you know, will all be engaging in that way, looking through Beethoven's eyes at the world of today and asking the questions we should ask today and what are the big issues we should be thinking about. So all those kids will be taking that journey through this project.
Now, one of the other focuses of the season is you'll be celebrating Isaac Stern. And as you pointed out in the presentation, certainly Carnegie Hall owes a good deal of its existence in part to him. How do you hope to celebrate him in dedicating your season to him?
Well, I mean, certainly the reason all of us are here now, you know, is because we'd all be doing, having completely different lives if it weren't for him. So the continued life of Carnegie Hall, obviously, is down to him, and for which we're so hugely thankful. Because, I mean, the reason I'm here, frankly, is because I don't think there's a music organization in the world that can make a greater contribution to people's lives through music, which is why, you know, this place is so inspiring. And I think it's obviously what inspired him and was the reason why he felt one had to fight to save it. So, you know, even if one thinks of some of our creations in recent years, like the National Youth Orchestra, National Youth Orchestra Jazz, I'm not sure whether any other institution could have done that in that way. So, you know, there's a power here which we have to use for good, and we have to use for the future of music. So partly, but we want to draw attention to him simply by dedicating the entire season to him. The Kavakos Mar Axe Trio will do all the Beethoven trios as well as the cello sonatas and piano sonatas. And again, that's a tribute very much to the Stern Rose Istomin Trio that did, you know, made this a similar project 50 years ago for Beethoven's 200th anniversary. And so we're paying tribute in that way. But the other thing we're doing is Isaac really, I mean, he was a great advocate for music, but also he was a great, great believer in, you know, pedagogy and teaching and making sure people had the opportunity to have access to music. So the inspiration we share with him is very much what drives the Weill Music Institute today. And I mean, I think he'd probably be thrilled by everything that has actually grown out of what he started. So we want to make sure we really reflect his work in that way. I mean, we'll have a huge violin day, you know, which will involve kids and as well as professionals. We'll have a big family day. So there's a lot of things we'll do that reflect all the different sides of who Isaac was, in terms of not only his great playing days, but his great advocacy and his great belief in education.
And your fourth perspective artist is Angélique Kidjo. What do you see her bringing to Carnegie Hall, and what are some of the things people can look forward to that she'll be curating and bringing to the season?
Well, I mean, firstly, she's been a huge champion for music in her own country, you know, the importance of music. She's also a great champion for African music and the influence of African music all around the world. So I think a lot of what she's going to be exploring is not just the fact that African-American music has had a huge impact on music and the development of music in the US, but really the influence of Africa in general all around the world in terms of the development of music. So, I mean, that's one of the things that's going to be central to what she's doing. We haven't got all the detailed programs yet, so I can't talk to you in detail about exactly what she's doing. But she's also been a very, very powerful political figure. She's, you know, she's really fought for human rights and for, you know, opportunities for people and so on. So I think she'll be expressing a lot of that as well. You know, the whole battle for human rights, you know, as will be a central part of her perspectives too.
And looking at the holder of the Debs Composer Chair, Jörg Widmann, how do you see him fitting into the season, and what are you looking forward to him bringing?
Well, Jörg is an extraordinary musician and talented in so many different ways. I mean, not only is he a great composer who's revered by so many of the artists we work with, but he's a conductor, he's a phenomenal clarinetist, and he speaks incredibly articulately about music. So he'll be doing two talks, you know, he'll be playing the clarinet, he'll be conducting, so, and obviously we're presenting a lot of his music. So I think it's going to be a really extraordinary experience for people to be able to engage with him on so many different levels as an artist and as a communicator about music. So I mean, we're very, very excited about having him involved. And the nice thing is when you have a composer that so many other artists want to engage with.
And as you referred to, there are just so many educational programs for young people, for families. So I want to return to the Weill Music Institute and their initiatives. As you've expanded the programs over the years, what has guided the new directions that you take its programming in?
Well, I think essentially at the heart of it is everybody has the right of access or the right to be able to engage with great music and great musicians. I mean, that guides us at the core, and the fact that music can transform lives and genuinely can. So, I mean, I guess, you know, our programs probably break down into three areas largely, which is kids and families in the widest sense. Nurturing talent, so things like the National Youth Ensembles, National Youth Orchestra, National Youth Orchestra Jazz, NYO2, Ensemble Connect, where we train the finest postgraduate musicians in America. It's a two-year fellowship where they really learn to work in prisons and hospitals and with schools and with kids and so on, so that they will spend their lives with portfolio careers putting something back into music and really supporting the future of music. So there's various things, and masterclasses, there's a lot we do in terms of nurture of talent. With Link Up, we now, you know, we continue to expand. It's really our flagship program in terms of how partnership can work and how one can deliver to organizations across the country, you know, through partnership and help everybody else to succeed and really look after the future of music. So Link Up now, we're working with 115 orchestras reaching about 400,000 people. You know, it's going a little bit more international every year as well. But the point is, you know, we raised $15 million a few years ago to really help us expand the program so that over the next 10 years, starting about 3 years ago, that over 10 years it would reach 5 million people. Now, the maths on that obviously is $3 a child. Now, if one didn't have partnerships, there is no way that we could deliver this sort of service to people across the country. So it tells you the power of partnership. And so we're looking to try and develop other programs in a similar way so that we use partnership to expand benefit. But it remains the poster child, really, for how that can work.
Mm. And just to remind the listeners, Linked Up directly connects orchestras, local orchestras, with both local and other school communities?
Absolutely. And it's for elementary school kids. And we help to train the orchestras. We help to train the teachers. And it's all about it's a rolling program, so it runs over several years. And it's about orchestras being able to really serve and engage with the kids in the schools in their area, at the elementary schools, in such a way that, you know, the kids not only learn about music, but they also participate, they learn instruments, and the closing concert involves every child playing with their orchestra. So everybody in the hall is performing as well as listening. And then the work we do in social impact, where people, you know, very often in very, very challenging and incredibly difficult circumstances, where we try and work with them in such a way that music can really be their pathway, you know, back into finding real meaning in their lives and being able to express themselves, you know, and find a role that they can play in life. So, I mean, that relates to the work we're doing in prisons. It relates to the work we're doing with young mothers, you know, many of whom are either incarcerated or homeless. I mean, you know, a lot of them in very trying circumstances. And so this whole area, you know, of really using music to help people who have to face massive challenges and very often, you know, really have had very few opportunities to do something creative with their lives and find their own creativity and their own voice. We're working in partnership with them to really try and help them to find those things.
Right. And you mentioned the National Youth Orchestra, NYO2, and last year NYO Jazz debuted. What type of feedback did you hear about that as far as how that really rounded out the opportunities you offer young musicians?
Well, I mean, firstly, it was great to have all of those young musicians together in SUNY Purchase. So you've got, you know, different sorts of musicians, although there's more crossover than one would expect, you know, because there are some people who are in the National Youth Orchestra or NYO2 who play jazz as well and vice versa. So, you know, it's not that there are hard lines between them, but, you know, having them all stimulate each other and engage with each other was terrific. But NYO Jazz had a huge impact in Europe. And I think one of the interesting things was, you know, it really came across from the responses of audiences just how much everybody wants to love America and how much America means to the world. So, you know, the response was quite extraordinary because obviously this is America's art form, or one of America's art forms, but it is definitely absolutely an American art form. And so people responded in an extraordinary way to that. So we'll be taking them. They were in Europe last year. They'll be going to East Asia this year and to China and Taiwan and South Korea and possibly Hong Kong. So, you know, we're just finalizing the tour. So, you know, and again, there's been huge demand, and which, you know, we weren't sure what the demand would be. But, you know, there are so many places that really want this jazz orchestra around East Asia as well. Europe, there was huge demand. So it's something we're enjoying, is the fact that people around the world love jazz as well.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of kind of segueing to new music, you mentioned that you're on track now to actually surpass 125 commissions. That was the goal you set when you celebrated your 125th anniversary. What are you most proud of regarding how this project has developed?
Well, I think one of the most important things that we set ourselves as a goal right at the beginning was co-commissioning, because one of the challenges around new music is you very often get people, you know, being enlightened and commissioning a new piece, and it's played once, and then, you know, it's not heard again. We very deliberately set out to do as many as possible of these pieces as co-commissions, and a very large number of them, a large percentage, are co-commissions, so that even at the very beginning, they had many performances, multiple performances. So I think that's been one of the most important things. Also, I'm very pleased about the fact that they've involved very, very diverse voices. So, you know, a lot of women composers, a lot of people of color. So, you know, there's been a lot of breadth and very different voices involved in the series as well. And look, this is only just, you know, it's a fantastic project. It's you know, it's involved a huge number of new commissions and new music, but it's just part of our pathway. And, you know, our commitment remains just as strong in the future to, you know, continuing to develop new music and support new music and new composers and really broaden, you know, making sure as many voices as possible are part of that.
And turning now to the upcoming Migrations Festival. And we had the chance last year when you announced the season to talk a bit about the thinking and the ideas behind the Migrations Festival. Certainly immigration remains as relevant and in the spotlight today as it was a year ago, even more so, some may argue. As you finalized the details of the festival, did you find your emphasis changing or heightening as we saw things play out day to day and in today's life?
Well, we had planned most of what was, well, not most, virtually everything that was going to happen in Carnegie Hall had been planned well before a year ago. So what has really, in the interim, what has happened is the partners who've joined us. The interesting thing is, and for whatever reason this might be, we haven't in-depth researched why so many people wanted to be part of this, but we're ending up with over 70 partners, which is more than double the greatest number of partners we've had for any festival to date. And it tells you that there are so many people, so many cultures, so many participants in American culture who want to say we are part and a central part of what has happened in America in terms of the development of culture. We've played our part. You know, we are part of how American culture has developed. So I think that's been one of the strongest things to come out of it, is this sense, you know, that it's such an inclusive, it's such an inclusive world. And, you know, everybody wants to be part of it, but they want to be part of America. So it's not saying we're something else, but, you know, our culture is part of what is America now. So I think that's the thing we've been most thrilled about. And, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, as we look forward to future festivals, whether this, you know, extraordinary expansion is something that will continue with other subjects as well. But certainly, the passion and the commitment and the drive for people to be part of this has been unique so far.
And it's all being curated under the planning and eye of Chris Teeley, who certainly brings his own unique voice and perspective. How has he helped shape the direction of where it's gone?
Well, he hasn't been responsible for the development of the project overall. He's been the artistic, oversight really for the single piece, which is the Scots-Irish.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we've had people advising on all the different dimensions of this, and there's been huge involvement in different ways. But Chris, Chris has been terrific in terms of how we've developed the Scots-Irish part. He launches the festival as well.
That was my conversation with Clive Gillinson, Executive and Artistic Director of Carnegie Hall. The Migrations Festival kicks off March 9th with a performance of Live From Here with Chris Teeley and runs through May. A full listing of the Migrations Festival events and next season's program can be found at carnegiehall.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.